Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Top of the week to you, internet. It is Monday, July 22nd, 2019, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 250. I am your host, Rob Zachney. Joining me is Danielle Riendo.
250! That's just, that's what I got. And that's the energy I got.
Kato, I can't see either of your faces.
What?
Oh, no!
I'm looking at the top of your head. Okay, now I see your face. Oh, but yeah, Danielle's
cut off.
You
can just see my hands. Yeah.
What happened?
I'll gesture wildly.
It's like she's a vandalized sculpture.
I am.
That's like I'm podcasting. Like the Visigoths sacked the city.
Truly. And that's who I am. Did you not know?
I fixed it.
Wait, can I give a bit of news? You guys, I got my blue belt.
What's up?
I got my blue belt.
Wow. Congrats.
In Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. That was
awesome.
My news. Thank you. It just means I'm intermediate and no longer a beginner. That's all it really means. Oh, and I can break people's knees in competition now. Isn't that exciting?
Wait, on purpose?
Yeah, I can do knee bars now.
Okay, but...
Most of the time people
tap,
don't worry.
Right.
They tap, don't worry.
Oh, I saw a movie...
I saw a movie about that once.
No, I mean, I literally saw the Art of Self-Defense this weekend, which just... Because there's a thing about tap or take a nap.
I mean... Tap or take a nap is much better than tap or break a bone. Right. Like, to be honest, it's much
personally,
better
personally, I'm
out.
A big fan of Warrior. Just Tom Hardy just being a big, sad dude. Oh, that's some good stuff.
That is good. Very good shit.
So I've had a weird morning.
Yeah, please tell.
Yeah, so MK decided that we need to start going to like this local dairy.
Okay.
And so now we have a milkman.
Nice.
Very old school. And last week we had our first delivery. And I usually get up around 6 in the morning. So you can imagine my shock when our Monday delivery, the phone rang at 5:30 in the morning.
What?
And yeah, because my phone is how I buzz people into my building. So my phone rang at 5:30 in the morning. I snap awake. I miss the call. But I'm standing there, and I'm like, well, they hung up. And I turn to MK, and I'm like, there's no way that was the delivery guy, right? And she's like, no, for sure that was the delivery guy. That was definitely the milkman. Honey, he's a milkman. This is when they come. And I'm like, excuse me, I'm from this century. I don't know when the milkman shows up. Like, this knowledge was lost with my grandparents.
Yeah.
So this week... I met the fill-in, the understudy milkman.
Oh.
And this time I saw him and I go downstairs and I swear to God, our milkman, he was waiting by his truck and he had struck a pose. And the only way I can describe him is like, imagine a like fourth generation, like Massachusetts farmer. Who seems like they are ready at any moment to break into a ska cover of Family Don't Matter.
Oh my God.
It was, yeah, so we like had the like ska punk organic milk farmer show
Great.
Up first thing in the morning.
Great.
So I am fucking exhausted. And also my kitchen is covered in little pieces of butter because MK also decided that now she's going to make her own cultured butter because this is what happens when you start binging It's Alive episodes, apparently. Mm-hmm. And like, so a couple weeks ago, it was like, hey, let's just put on some Bon Appetit videos for fun. That'll be great.
Yeah.
And now MK is like, I think I need a kimchi jar.
Yeah.
And I'm going to leave this cream out over the weekend, so it turns into, so it begins culturing and into butter. Yes. But now I need to churn it this morning in the stand mixer, and that is going to fling.
Wait a second.
Yeah, Kata.
I was on board until you got into the stand mixer.
Wait, what time was she culturing this butter? Is this also at 5:30 well, in the morning?
It was culturing all night, all weekend.
I'm sorry, churning. What time was she churning the butter at this point?
Like, well, like 6:15.
Oh, great. My God.
And the problem was it was still wet enough. There's still enough buttermilk in it that kept like spraying out of the stand mixer. Yeah. And she was like, I think I got it all. Bye. I'm going to work. So I was just in the kitchen making coffee and everything, I mean everything, has like little bits of like butter dangling off of it.
Right.
Like all the hardware in the kitchen, there's like little pieces of butter here and there, like just stalactites like hiding beneath kitchen fittings. The butter is
you
pretty delicious
cat.
Though, I gotta say.
Oh,
nice. That's great. Fermented chicken's good stuff.
I don't know. So I've seen what happens when cats get into like really rich dairy, though. It can
I
be a bad scene.
As well. Yeah. It's Ori. So I like popcorn a lot. This is a thing in my life. I am not a cook. I'm not a chef. Most of my meals consist of cauliflower rice and vegetables and cheese in some sort of fashion. Or granola made with walnuts, mostly. So I don't really cook. However, I have a popcorn maker. I have a hot air popper, and I enjoy me some popcorn. And I melt a little butter in the microwave. And Ori, my tiny cat, the cat that, once destroyed a game of Into the Breach for me, she really enjoys butter water. The water I put, in the little cup to, make it easier to wash. She really likes it. Great. I have to hide it from her, or if we have issues.
Butter water.
She loves the butter water. It's her
little
thing.
GI issues?
You know, it's just like, thank God
little
cats
delicate kitty
use
tongue.
A litter box. Thank God. Just thank fucking God. Because my dog, I bless his soul, he's still not great about certain things.
You don't need two animals like laying waste to the apartment.
It's correct. Yeah. One's enough.
Laying
waste indeed.
No, true,
my friend.
True. Well, anyway, speaking of laying waste, though, so how did y'all bear the heat? Because I basically hid in my cave this week. I didn't see the sun most of Saturday. I just pulled the shades at because if I leave the shades up, I begin losing the battle with the heat by mid-morning. Like, my AC will just start losing the battle. With the shades down, there's enough insulation and lack of direct sunlight that I was able to keep it at, 73 in my apartment all day, which was pretty awesome.
Bad. Yeah.
That's all right.
But it did mean I never saw the sun. Right. So I just entered this, gaming fugue state. I did, four F1 2019 races and just, straight crushed it.
Nice.
I was really on fire. But I did sort of have that weird, I don't know. It feels strange when you go an entire day and you have no sense of time, right? It's like, I just turned my house into a submarine, today. Today the heat's broken, but the entire town smells like trash. And that made me think, I'll bet New York sucks right now.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
You can smell the trash before you can see the trash.
It's true. Yeah.
It's not great. it was, so I can never fight heat above 95 in my apartment with my very sad small AC. So I bear it long enough to get somewhere that has AC, like a movie theater or a mall, and just spend as much time as possible in industrial strength AC rather than try to stay at home because my apartment is, sunny.
Yeah.
In one room, and that room will always be 5 degrees hotter than it really is, just because of all the reflecting sun. It's hell. I saw a movie. That's
What'd
what
you
I
see?
Saw. Oh, The Art of Self-Defense.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah. We talked already. Yes, you've told me about this.
You learn to kill a man.
God, that movie. If we still had Be Good and rewatch it, it'd be like, you know what? We should talk about this. This movie's a lot. But yeah, it was a very interesting. What's the word I'm looking for?
After not, getting attacked on the street, Casey enlists in a local dojo that's run by a charismatic and mysterious sensei.
Yep.
He soon uncovers a sinister fraternity of violence and masculinity while learning how to defend himself. Did they just, like, mash up Karate Kid and Fight Club?
Kind of. Yeah, wow. Kind of. A little bit. But it's self-aware in a way where it's like it's what I'm the word I'm looking for is like not satire, Jesus,
like critique,
not even, or like, yeah, like critique, but more like it's like self-reflexive in a way. It like, yeah, but like, yeah, it is critiquing that sort of violent masculinity, and like it's very creepy. In a good way, though, like you could see where taking these sort of characters and taking these sort of situations could turn into like people agreeing with certain ideas, but like they made sure to like make the kind of more toxic ideas in this film like feel very obviously wrong.
Yeah.
So
trying to avoid the Tyler Durden problem,
right? Exactly. That's
people
the thing.
Come out of that movie being like, "That guy fucking owns."
Right. Exactly. Exactly. They, I think, and they think they did that well in this one. Yeah.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. It's worth a watch, I think.
That's extremely good. I did a lot of jujitsu and I watched a lot of fights.
Good.
There were
also indoor stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely indoor stuff. Although I will say, wrestling in this heat is like. 3 rounds feels like 27.
Jesus.
At least.
Yeah.
I also like I was not on my ambulance this weekend. I will be next weekend, but my ambulance was actually like conscripted by FDNY all weekend because of the heat emergency. It was like, "Hey, instead of just kind of going on calls when you feel like it, y'all, how about how about you're on our time right now and like, you know, doing more specific calls," which is that happens when it, like, is this bad. I did actually call an ambulance for somebody this weekend. That was a thing that I did. So everything had to do with the heat or fighting for me this right. weekend,
nice.
Basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, speaking of, so, you know, the ambulance.
Yes.
A sort of vehicle of the urban landscape.
A taking confessional people to space. And fro. Yes,
yes,
if you will.
Indeed. Danielle, I see you've caught the bug. Yes. You've been playing a little bit of Nightcall.
Yes, and I am really, really loving it. Absolutely, and it's possible that I might write a little bit about this, but in the spirit of our colleague Patrick Klepek, who often uses the podcast to sort of workshop ideas occasionally for pieces, y'all let me know what you think. But I definitely have found a real emotional resonance with not just the writing itself, but with the sort of concept of strangers pouring their hearts out to you. Which is a thing that I witness all the time when I'm on my ambulance. I frequently have people kind of telling me their life story or telling me like all about their problems. Obviously, being in an ambulance, you're in either in a medical, like a severe medical emergency or emotional emergency. Those we actually attend to as well. And if I end up writing about this, I'll probably write about a specific call I had the weekend prior to this weekend where I had a woman who just was having a meltdown, just like an emotional, absolute meltdown. And, you know, really, really, really laid it all out, like what was going on in her life, what was going on with her husband, with her kids, with work, with how she feels controlled by things, with how frustrated she was with so many other aspects of life, how she tries to get mental health care, like people that she calls for help, like when things are really bad, like all of it, you know, really all of this kind of stuff that comes out of people. And in Night Call, you're a cab driver. You're not obviously taking people to the hospital most of the time, but people come into your cab. It's late at night. Sometimes they're drunk. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're just having a bad day or having a great day. In the case of a poet, she seems to be having a great day. And they tell you about their lives, which is both a conceit that, Rob, I know you had some... like the dramatization of this and like how extreme this is in the game, like everybody pours their heart out to you. Completely agree. That's a little like even in my ambulance, not everybody is telling me their life story, right? And the cab is a less emotionally strenuous environment at that. So it's like, yeah, for sure. That is, I think, a factor where the game is not necessarily realistic. But when it does hit, I think it hits really, really well. My very first call in the game, and I guess in case folks hadn't heard the last episode, Nightcall is like an interactive fiction game. You play as a cab driver, Hussein, who is, he survived a murder. He survived an attempted murder and has been sort of blackballed into helping the cops find this murderer who's on the loose. But most of the game is driving your cab in Paris and meeting all these sort of interesting characters in Paris, including a cat and maybe Santa and a lot of interesting people sort of along the way and political figures and writers and all kinds of folks who you wrote about in your review, which y'all should go read because it's really, really good. But that sort of emotional resonance of the people who do, you know, read as real in the moment. My very first call was somebody you mentioned in the last episode, which was the young woman who she's studying to be a lawyer, failed the bar exam, really wants to be a dancer, and she's on the phone with mom the whole time. And this really made me think of my patient from the other weekend because she was on the phone with her mom, like, during half of this call. She was, like, on the phone with her mother begging us, like, please, like, I need help. I don't know what to do. And she's also saying this to her mom, like, on the other line. So it was very, like, oh, wow, there's, like, this weird connection. They're obviously very different in terms of their lives and what's going on in their lives. But these are both, like, women who are on the phone with their moms about some sort of failure or some sort of thing that has made them unhappy. And now they're pouring their heart out to me, basically, which was super weird and interesting. I am loving this game, even though I don't think it needed that detective layer, which you also write about in the review of, like, I don't even know how it works, really. I just know I'm collecting evidence. It's not even like you're looking at the evidence. It just kind of shows up on this board of, like, oh, this was a clue. And I'm like, I just wanted to read that newspaper article, actually. Like, this world is what's interesting to me. This case is not terribly interesting to me, but I understand why. There is this sort of trend, I feel like, in a lot of IF pieces to make it a little more gamey, you know, to make, you know, add those sorts of extra layers of gameplay on occasion. And it's like, this was good enough without that, basically.
So, the other, when I was, before I could write up my review, I found myself revisiting The Simple Art of Murder, which is Raymond Chandler's critical essay on detective fiction. And he's writing it from sort of the midway point of the century, right? And so the detective genre, or at least the modern detective genre, still in its adolescence, I'd say, when he's writing it. There's really, we've only just moved a generation beyond people being like Conan Doyle imitators.
Yeah.
But one of the things that he observes at the start of the piece, and I think this is really very true of something like Nightcall, is that a really great detective novel is actually incredibly difficult to write because the different parts of a murder mystery require accessing completely different sensibilities and spheres of knowledge. And so the argument he makes is that sort of the intricate logistician who's going to arrange these real knotty whodunit problems is probably not going to be the person who also has a great sense of how people talk and what moves and motivates them. The person who is the natural dramatist who does have an understanding of human interactions and dialogue probably isn't going to be the person who has a great deal of like forensic knowledge about here are different types of poison. Here is how the, you know, New York City phone system is set up as opposed to the Paris phone system. Like that person is that's probably a different person. And a lot of times in mysteries, what we're kind of hoping for is someone who's going to run the table on those, right? Someone who's going to create a story that's going to be a really satisfying whodunit, but also it's going to have convincing characters. And also maybe you'll learn something about like how the, you know, just weird esoteric knowledge that comes up in a murder case. But that person doesn't exist, right? Like that's that's an incredibly tall order. And I think Nightcall is very much an example of really what you had here was a desire to write a series of scenes. It's a series of small one-set plays between characters. And in the process of that, in the backdrop of that, all of it's going to be shaped and framed by this murder mystery. But the people who made this game are not mystery writers. There's not, it's like they've watched a lot of mysteries. They've seen a lot of TV. I'm sure they've read a bunch. But in terms of like how they work and what makes people sort of stop and labor over who said what and what the witnesses, you know, what the witness statements were, they don't really have access to that. And so you end up with this real weird murder board of here's, you know, according to this person, the killer is exactly, 1 meter, 80 centimeters.
Yeah.
And, but according to this person was killed by somebody who was less than 179 centimeters. And I'm like, I don't think that doesn't seem real. I question the medical examiner who came up with that.
Yeah, I almost get the sense, and I'm still fairly early on. I've played a couple hours. I almost get the sense that your character, that Hussein himself, like, doesn't know how any of this bullshit works, and that he's just doing the thing that that intelligent and reasonable people do when they don't know what the fuck they're doing, which is like just write it all down. Like, it could be important. Write it down. You know, that kind of thing, and just throwing it on a board. Where you're tasked with organizing things on this board, I don't even know what to do. I'm just like, if it didn't come with a string attachment, I don't know. I don't know where to put it. Yeah. I have no context for like any of this. So I just want to go back to talking to interesting people and cats. And yeah, I got the cat second. That was my second call on the entire game. And
like, things went off the rails fast.
Yeah, it was immediate. It was the woman who failed the bar exam, and then the cat. Like those were I saw the cat, and I was like, oh, is that the cat? Oh my god, let me go. And I didn't know if it was like the cat's picture, and then it would be like, oh, a person with a cat. No, it was the cat.
That was my assumption. I was like, somebody's gonna be taking their cat to a vet, but yeah. No, it's a cat. Don't chase the cat off. It's a sad, like, it's just, you'll feel bad.
Yeah.
Is what I'll say, because the cat will be like very upset you didn't take it to the train station. It's terrible.
Yeah, the cat was very
happy. I think it's a, I really like this game. Some of these scenes are so well executed, but I do wish that all these conversations added up to maybe being the solution to the mystery. In some sense, and that you sort of saw the same, and I think this is the other place this game lets itself down a little bit. I think for a game structured like this, what would be really effective is if you had sort of a longer case rather than just like a week to investigate all this. You had a longer case and you encountered more of these people again and again and again until you began to realize, oh shit, I think this person that I've shared all these confidences with might be the killer.
Yeah.
And instead, like in like two of the three cases, I think I've had one interaction with the killer prior to sort of tapping them as the prime suspect. But what that precludes is that sort of sinking feeling of revelation you get when you realize like, oh shit. This person, you know, this person who I like, this person has a compelling story, let something slip they probably shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And now everything is different. Like, that's kind of what's missing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it would have been a, like, unreserved recommendation, like, great game if it sort of delivered on that. But
yeah.
So it delivers, I think, a lot of really good scenes, but they're not all good scenes.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I would completely agree with that. The connective tissue between the sort of mystery side and the talking to people in your cab side is it does feel very disparate, and that, you know, yeah. But I am sort of loving it. And I was actually playing the other night. I was just like screen sharing it with my partner and just kind of like, this is kind of the perfect game for that sort of thing, in the way that a lot of Telltale games were great for playing with a partner. Like, one person's at the controls or at the keyboard, and like, you're both kind of like, oh, what's the right decision here, what's the right call here, you know. You have time to do that in a lot of cases. Like, I'm not playing it on the auto version or whatever. I'm clicking through every sort of interaction that we're having. I'm
yeah.
clicking through at my pace, basically, so I could sit there for half an hour and think like, what should I do with this? And, you know, that is just a really fun way of enjoying a story together. So I'm also appreciating it on that sort of level, which is pretty cool. I do enjoy whenever a game comes along that's like that good for sort of co-playing something.
Yeah, and it's just got a good vibe. Right? Yeah. Like good music, kind of just an attractive, like it feels kind of cozy and intimate the way like a city at night and a nice clean car, you know, can sort of cocoon you against the night air and be a stage for a great conversation. Yeah, I do like it. And again, like if you have Xbox Games Pass, I think it's on there right now.
Oh, shit.
So
okay.
Definitely worth a flyer if, you know, if you're curious. What's up, Kyla?
I was just wondering. Sorry. I was looking, trying to find if Neo Cab was out. Because I'm curious how these.
The Cyberpunk Cab game.
Yeah, I'm curious how these are going to, like,
I think that's
compare.
Still in development.
Yeah. I was seeing, like, in 2019.
The original Cyberpunk Cab game is Quarantine.
There's a little bit of cab going on in Observer, but very little. But a little. Rutger Hauer sure is in a cab at the beginning of that game. Or a spinner, if you will.
And then the clicker Crazy Taxi was like kind of lefty, right?
I never played that. Let me see what that is.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that existed.
Yeah, yeah. I think we can check that out at some point. We can, you know, we've been looking for SEO rich content.
Right.
Maybe truly.
Like top cab games with good politics. We can sort of start working on that list. So speaking of maybe not so good politics, Kata, let's talk about why you're problematic. No, let's talk about the, union beliefs you've been getting from Nowhere Profit. You talked a little bit about this card game last week. And the thing that I remembered being kind of perturbing was the fact that it basically sounded like their idea of the union faction was stuff they vaguely remembered from 1984.
Yeah, no, it definitely, so it's strange because it's, so the full name of the faction is the Union of the Five Fingers. Their army is called the Fist, obviously. But they were a union pre this apocalyptic thing, right? Like they were like the miners union or whatever. And then post this apocalyptic thing, which it's been a while since the whole, like they call it the crash happened. What they've become now is this like fascistic, you know, state where they like will execute people for thinking differently. There is a specific line where they say, for getting in the way of our glorious revolution. So, there's definitely
That's
something.
Basically, how Patco was before Reagan took care of it.
Yep.
Which really struck me as odd. Really, the thing is, it feels like a lot of the... So, you gather people to follow you from every faction, any faction. And so, the way that these factions are kind of delineated feels strange when they're not addressed in the way that you're gathering people. Like, it's just like, oh, these are all... Like, it's I have a bunch of unionist people on my side. Are they... Like, they never really contend with, like, that. First off, like, it's weird that faction is called the Union. And, like, the idea that that's, like, an inevitable end state for Union ideals is bad from the get-go. But another thing that this game does kind of oddly is not really contend with the fact that the way they describe and portray all of these factions are... such like it's so extreme that it never feels like they're really they don't like think about the issue of like how did I get these people on my side. A lot of times you end up recruiting people for money, like basically as mercenaries, but the way that then they get deployed in certain story beats is as if they like suddenly become like devout followers of your cause, even though what you did in the game was you gave them batteries, and they're like, yeah, sure, I'll come along. It falls into this thing where, like, because every faction that you can recruit from is also the factions that are, like, there are no cards or there are no people in this game that are not also possible to be recruited. Like, they're every enemy you encounter is also part of a faction or because it's a card based thing, right? Like, every card that the enemy plays is also a card that you could actually own. But, like, yeah, it doesn't ever really so, like, it describes all of these
sense of friction from,
right? Or, like, and, like, there could be ways to set up some factions to not, like, the descriptions for all the factions are 100% antagonistic in this way where, like, it feels like it's you against the world, but not in a convincing way. It's like, really, there aren't any other altruistic, like, factions in this entire universe. Like, everyone is, like, out against you for some reason in a weird way. Like, I don't know. And, like, oh, another faction naming thing that really just isn't great is the nomadic, you know, sort of tribal faction called the Ferals, which, you know, is a fun way to describe people that, you know, don't live in the cities, you know. That's literally, like, the only difference is that, like, after the crash, they went to live in nature instead of trying to rebuild it within one of the destroyed cities. It's weird. And, like, there was one thing that happened to me. Well, there was one small glimpse where I came upon a group of people from a mercenary group called the Blue Devil Mercenaries, who, again, like every other faction, they've all, like, been described as antagonistic and, like, very, like, there's no like grays in between ever described, except for this one moment that I've had, which is part of the reason I'm still sticking with it and trying to get to the end, because essentially I come upon them doing funerary rites for some of their fallen members, and in this, like, moment I could actually join them and pray for their fallen members, and, like, even though every other encounter I've ever had with any other faction is always, like, either I come to an uneasy truce where, like, they let me pass, like, and continue on my way, or it ends in a fight. And this was the only one where, as far as I could tell, there was no way for a fight to even break out. So it's entirely possible that because this game is very hard, you're supposed to get past 4 maps worth of, like, stuff to get to the end of it. I've only ever gotten to past the first 2. And this encounter happened in the second map once. So, like, it's possible there's more things like that later on, or there's supposed to be a turn of some sort. But, like, it's a problem that this sort of game, this, like, a roguelike like this, has with narrative. If you're going to hold back information like that, but your game is very hard and it'll take a very long time to get to the end,
yeah,
if it feels like I know I may have if it weren't for the fact that I kept getting this, like, single, like, glimpse into, like, slightly more nuanced storytelling, I might have already dropped it for being like, this seems weird. Like, I mean, it's good otherwise. That's the other thing, is that it's actually very, like, completely mechanically, it's a very fun card game. And the, like, mechanics of having to keep your followers alive, like, make you play a card game differently, where before, like, I mentioned this before, like, when you play other games like Magic or Hearthstone or things like that, you tend to see the pieces on the board as expendable. And, like, you really lose that sense of, like, oh, I can just throw this at that because it doesn't matter if it dies, when they've set this up as, like, they're this group of followers, and if they die, twice, that's it. The card's gone. Like, they're dead. You know, this permadeath aspect.
Yeah.
So all of that is really interesting. But then, like, the weird, the, like, very, like, black or white and, like, lack of nuance is like, throwing me off from, like, really, like, 100% loving this game.
Yeah.
Plus the, like, weird ways that they describe those factions. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a trap, like, to fall into for writing a game, right? Even if, and this is giving them a lot of credit, but even if they have some sort of other message or they're doing something with this eventually, which who knows if they are, but, like,
yeah.
If you set things up in such a way, very few people finish games, right? Like, very few people will actually see the end of a game, especially, like, a very difficult game. So it's, like, if you're doing something with it, you got to kind of at least foreshadow that you're doing something with it, right?
Yeah, and there hasn't been much, unfortunately.
Well, it also sounds like then that thing where, like, your party, your group has to be the good guys, which means every other ideology presented in the world has to be somehow bad.
Right.
Like, you are the only virtuous
which is society
wandering the wastes.
Which is complete, you know. I don't know.
These people believe in worker solidarity, but ooh, too much.
Too much.
These people are out and out fascists, but ooh, too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a right amount, damn it, and by God, your party is going to find it. And that's why everyone
your party already found it. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
You're the ones that are just the right amount of everything.
You're the big word.
Yeah. And, like, there's ways to tell stories where, obviously, like, you're supposed to be the good guys, but, like, having other people that you can ally with or, like, see at least as equals in the world is, I think, important to making a world feel more fleshed out and not so just, like, you good, everyone else bad.
Yeah, for sure.
So, actually, you know what? Let's take a quick break, because then I need to get into what I was playing this weekend.
All right.
So we will we have to do a little board game check-in right after the break.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, so the other thing I did this weekend was I visited some friends, and we ended up playing a couple board games, and it was getting progressively hotter as we were hanging out playing these games, and so we probably played them in the wrong order. The first game we played was Restoration Games' Fireball Island, are you familiar with this? Do you remember the original Fireball Island at all? I don't remember it.
No.
So this is the first time encountering it.
Fireball Island.
Yeah, it's kind of a toy game. It's shades of, like, Don't Wake the Dragon or something like that, where you just run characters around this.
Don't Wake the Dragon?
Yeah.
Don't Wake Daddy?
What?
Is that the same thing?
Daddy the Dragon?
No, no. that game in the 90s.
Don't Wake Daddy.
Yeah. No, that was a thing.
It was a thing. Fireball Island, let me look at this, because I've played something like this before. The original, I think.
I have no memory of this, Kata.
of Don't Wake Daddy?
Don't Wake Daddy.
I don't remember it at all.
The commercial was this kid like trying to sneak around a house in the dead of night. Yeah,
Yeah, now I'm watching a very old commercial about this. It's priceless. It's there's some kids superimposed over the board. It's fantastic. And Daddy is this kind of just nightmare, like golem-like creature at the center of the board that like just sits bolt upright into watchfulness.
Like a weird...
really, like, captures our sublimated fears of our fathers.
I think so.
Anyway, so what this game is,
I think I've
it's this huge, really detailed, pretty plastic board of this like fucking Temple of Doom style island with like a giant volcano slash totem in the center of the island that will launch fireballs at intervals as you loot the treasure. And like, so basically you're all a bunch of, your combination, like what if Indiana Jones was also like a shitty tourist on a booze cruise?
Yes.
And that's kind of who you people are. Like everyone is there to both like just loot shit off this island, but also take good snapshots. And they're all worth victory points. And can you get back to the helicopter before the island like basically explodes?
So you're influencers. Yeah. What you're saying. All right. Good.
And presumably once Fireball Island is destroyed, you release like an apology video or something like that.
Yep, of course.
no. So what? So it's very simple. Like you get cards and they each have like move 10 spaces. And each time you move like a move past treasure, you can just grab a piece of treasure. The more matching types of treasure you have, the more points you get. But then a lot of times as you're running around looting stuff, a card will say like move 10, take treasure, but also advance like the Cataclysm track and release all the fireballs. And so this statue at the center of the island, this volcano, Volcar, you drop a little like bearing through the top of its head, and then from there it can go three directions, out the front, like through the mouth, or like out the ears to the sides. And then it's just kind of anybody's guess where those balls are going to go. They will just go falling down the island. And if they knock your characters over, like you lose treasure. Mm. You also have the option to like flick boulders at other people's characters. So you can be like, you finish a move and knock one of the boulders over. And these are sort of set in these positions all around the island. And you're not allowed to like totally flick them so they go airborne, but you can like push them in a direction to see if you can get them to like fall into a track where they will hit another person's character.
Oh.
It's a very silly game. It's it's very light. I crushed it.
Yeah.
I was just it's just a total like skill free game. I mean, like there's a little skill. Like you have to get pretty good at like flicking those boulders at other characters, and I did.
Nice.
But yeah, I but at the same time, like I also just got a lot of good cards, and so I moved the farthest, which means I looted the most treasure, and then I left. And yeah.
Good.
Yeah, and so I won pretty handily. So that was the first game we played, and it was fine, it was light, it was easy. Then we played this game called Coimbra by Flaminia Brasini and Virginio Gili. And it was described to me as, oh, it's a Euro game. You know, worker placement, some drafting.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's a Euro game. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought I like, but the thing is, I haven't played a lot of the more recent Euro games. So if you're familiar with this, in board game spaces, a lot like Euro games are basically anything that's not like a 1970s style like American war game or like a Hasbro or Parker Brothers type old family board game, right? Like Euro games were always used to describe slightly better designed, frequently like non-confrontational board games. So Settlers of Catan is kind of the classic example. That was what sort of the first probably Euro game like mega hit. Agricola is another. Pandemic, honestly, is basically like sort of done in the Euro game style. But all these things that I'm describing tend to be pretty straightforward, easy enough to parse like how the theme relates to the mechanics. It was like 85 degrees and climbing fast as they began to explain to me the mechanics of Coimbra.
Oh, boy.
And we should go to Board Game Geek real quick.
Okay.
And just pull up the like screenshots of the board so you can sort of see what I'm getting into here.
How do we spell this? Just about, you know.
Coimbra.
So the city in Portugal?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay, I guess I have to put game, board game. Coimbra board game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy so, God.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah. So, nobody, by the way, told me what this game was about. They just started explaining the rules because what the game is about will probably not actually help you.
Oh, God.
It is a time of like great prosperity in the city of Coimbra, and the city is sort of divided between the ruling council and the church and the scholars and the merchants. You know, two things make the city run, force and money. And also, though, there's people on there's like four sets of dice. And
Jesus, then dice there's tokens?
And then there's the pilgrims going on their journey through Coimbra and its environs to holy sites. And all these things will advance you up the four tracks, the council track, the merchant track, the church track, and I think like the academy track. But then you also roll like 12 dice at the start of each turn, and then people draft which dice they want.
Oh, okay.
So you can be like, I want the six. And then you can also use those to buy character cards, which are laid out to the left of the board. But here's the catch.
56 of them. 56 character cards.
Yeah, there's three sets of four. There's 12. Laid out at a time. At the end of a turn, all the character cards go away. Those cards at the bottom, Kado, those are voyages. Don't worry about those.
Wait, what?
Oh, wow.
God damn
it's
it.
Portugal. There's oceanic expeditions happening. We'll get to those in just one quick second. But also, off to the side, there's these character cards, and there's 12 of them, and you get to, like, buy them, but here's the catch. So if you like put a six down next to a row of character cards, chances are that means you are the first person who's going to get to draft because six is the highest. And so you get the highest priority. But you'll also have to pay either six coins or six guards to buy it. So you can try to undercut people and be like, I'm going to put a two in and I'm just going to get a cheap card.
Right.
Can I read anyway. This? Sentence from a review linked on Board Game Geek from the Tabletop Times.
Go for it.
It describes the complexity of the game, and it says, "Well, this complexity suits the game and acts to mask some of the back-end victory point calculation. It does seem like this game could be unpleasant with players prone to analysis paralysis, particularly at higher player counts." Is it analysis paralysis, or is it people who are like me who are just gawking at all the numbers and colors and being like,
that was me. Like, it was, there were two people who played it before. There was MK, who just like intuitively understood the logic of this.
Sure.
Gotcha.
And then there was me, who was like, I was staring at the board and I was like, none of this makes sense. Like, a lot of times in Euro games, the board itself can kind of give you clues about how it's going to work. Like, there's certain like formulas and calculations that are represented on the board that sort of let you figure out, like, you do this, that turns into this resource, and that resource can be used to buy victory asset Y or something like that. Usually you can parse this. I was looking at this thing and it felt like one of those dreams where the final, like they're giving the final that morning at school and you didn't study and you never took the class, but you have to take it. So it's like
map with numbers on it.
What is by it? The time the explanation stops, it's like 87 degrees. Like, I am just starting to like panic and people are making moves and people are like this game is great. Oh, I love the elegance of this. And I am just like doing things to try to keep the game moving without like letting on that I don't know what is happening. And so, but here's the weird thing. So I sort of,
what is this?
Oh yeah, dog, the pilgrims have got to go around Portugal, man. That's what pilgrims do. You got to get your pilgrims around Portugal and they go to different holy sites that allow you to advance on the different tracks for the council or the merchant or the church track. So the pilgrimages are incredibly important. Guess which part of the game I didn't understand? Because like I was like, okay, wait. So I think I know how to. I can use the dice to set up. Like I can bid on things using these dice. Great, I've got it. And I'm just gonna do that because I seem to understand that, and I can just buy things off of that. And then it occurs to me, round like when it's 91 degrees inside, that I'm like, wait. It's weird though that like a third of the space on this board is this like map of pilgrim sites.
Right. It's a pretty it's a pretty big chunk.
Yeah. It's like often like, you know, in design, like size equals importance, right? Like that's kind of a visual principle of like, you know, info design. And I was like, damn, like weird that they would have this big map in this sort of like card drafting game. Wonder what that's about. So last thing, by the way, so all the cards also have, you go through the drafting phase and then all the cards also have like second order effects later in the turn. So if like certain cards will be like in this phase, if you've played two purple dice, you get two gold. For each purple dice you played, you get like two gold. So take two gold for just having done that. So that's another thing you can calculate. And then when all is said and done, you've made all these decisions and you've activated various tracks, which give you other resources. Then you can invest in the expeditions, which basically are like, if you've played Waterdeep, Lords of Waterdeep or something like that, they're like bonus victory conditions. And this is where things can get a little crafty because people can be sort of architecting powerful endgame scoring conditions that are not immediately obvious on the board. Like you look at the state of play on the board, but you don't realize that someone has paid for an expedition that will, and this was basically what I ended up doing. I kept drafting council characters, the black characters, and they're little, like the town council, little black cards with a little white key on them. And for every one of those I had, I got two victory points. And I was sitting on like eight of these things. And so, and I had them sort of like stacked hidden in my hand, just like, I wasn't showing that off. So I was like, this seems like a play. Sure. If I do this, surely I won't need to use the pilgrimage track
at all.
But no. And then like on the next to last turn, I was like, wait, why is everyone so far ahead? And then like it dawned, I was like, wait, what are all these symbols on the pilgrim track? It's like, those are the things they give you, Rob. And I was like, wow, they let you advance all these tracks all at once? And it was like, yeah, man. Yeah, they do. And I was like, damn, the game done changed. And so then I was frantically trying to like get a bunch of pilgrims around the board. But what occurred to me while I was playing this is, you know how like with craft beer, there was like the rush to just brew hoppier and hoppier IPAs. Like it just became the thing where it's like, damn, like the mark of a real beer as opposed to like mass market domestic beers is that real beer, like good IPAs, have like a big hoppy character. They're kind of bitter. They got really tannic flavor. And so to make a better one of those, I'm just going to crank all of that up. And then beer nerds are going to be like, damn, do you just taste how fucking hoppy this is? I love it. I think that's happened in Euro games. Coimbra is like a fairly recent game. And playing it, it just felt to me like in the end, it did start to feel cool. Like once I did around like the last turn where I kind of internalized the logic of this game and it stopped feeling like I was just trying to like bullshit my way through a class, until the bell rang. Once it sort of clicked, there was kind of a cool elegance to it that I appreciated. But everything to that point, to get me to that point, it just felt like we are now like over 10 years into this Eurogame revolution. And it's being driven by this desire for just like wildly ornate.
Yeah.
Mathematical structures.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have gotten very far in this game. I could tell you that. It does remind me, I could tell you what kind of board gamer I am. There was once upon a time I went on vacation with a bunch of friends and we had the Game of Thrones board game, which is a cool and interesting game, I think. I've actually played it before with people who knew what they were doing. But we set up the board and that took us 2 hours. And then we promptly were like, oh, we're hungry, and ended up making dinner and leaving the board set up on the dinner table and then just made dinner and never actually played the game. Which is very sad. But I guess we had some fun with it. I start losing the thread pretty early in a lot of rules heavy board games, personally.
Well,
to my shame.
I don't have the kind of brain that comprehends rules explanations well. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Like, if a game is a machine, I need to see the machine run for a couple like revolutions before I understand like how it works. But if it's just explained, it's like 50 times harder for me to parse like what's going on. But once I've seen the engine turn over, I'm like, oh wait, so this actually is the belt that connects to this, and when this moves, all these other dependent variables rotate with it, and I kind of get it. Yeah. But yeah, like sitting through these explanations with just like, just in this ripping hot room, and I'm just like fucking getting flop sweats as I try to figure out like how I'm going to play this game. It was quite suspenseful. It was nerve-wracking. But I did well. I ended up coming in second.
Oh, hey. Oh,
nice. Yeah.
Pretty close. Because I had stuck to the few things I knew early on, I had pushed a couple strategies basically as far as they could go. And that served me pretty well. Like, I had min-maxed, but my max was my comprehension, and my min was just all the shit I didn't understand until much later in the game.
Fair.
So that's my review of Coimbra. It's a Euro game.
But you're saying you should have started with the other game and then, with this.
I should have started with Coimbra.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Fireball Island.
It always feels, the more complicated a game's rules are, the more often I want to be able to play it. Because I feel like if I'm investing that much time just understanding the thing, I want to be able to go back to it multiple times. Case in point, the one like big board game that I played for like 3 years with my friends in Baltimore was called Zombicide. And that was essentially, I mean, it's like, think about like things like the D&D combat system situation, like where you're rolling dice to do attacks and things like that. Like that's, it's about as complex, but mostly it's just like takes a lot of time to really understand, because the way it works is it's a cooperative game, and the board game, all the zombies on the board are moved by certain rules, and the way that those rules interact aren't always super clear, to the point where they put out multiple addendums and what's the word for it,
errata.
Yeah, multiple rule errata to kind of clarify, like, oh, yeah, we made something entirely too complex. Sorry about that. Here's all these edge cases that we totally missed.
Yep.
But once
that happens a lot in the indie space, too.
Right. Yeah, totally. And it feels like once you've put in the time to, like, understand the rules, it's, like, worth it if you're going to play it more than the one time, which, you know, most board games are infinitely replayable because you're just trying to win again, but something I don't know where I was going with that.
Like, a lot of times these games only sort of reveal themselves until you're beginning to interact with the actual strategies,
right?
But the first time you play it, where you're learning how the system actually works, you're just trying to see, like, you're almost going
through motions to try to, you know, parse what things will, you know, domino into other things.
Right. Like Seven Wonders is an easy-ish game to get into playing, but the problem is until you, like, know what cards are in there and, like, just what just how the game tends to flow toward the end. Until you've done that a few times, you're entirely reactive. You're not planning for anything. But once you know what's potentially in your hand, then the game completely changes. But how often? But then you're up against the how often am I going to get people together to play with this? Which is the which is really where the rubber meets the road with board games. Because on one hand, they're the things that sort of let us hold on to our friendships in the 30s, but they're also the things that sort of highlight the degree to which those friendships begin to atrophy.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. All right, let's pause for some questions. Real quick. So Harry writes, I've been working my way through Dishonored 2 lately, and I recently got to the Dust District mission. In it, you're tasked with breaking into mining magnate Aramis Stilton's mansion, whose house is secured by a special lock that's guarded by a multivariable, dubiously worded logic puzzle, the Jindosh riddle. The riddle totally consumed me. While there were other ways to break into the mansion, I felt like I absolutely needed to solve it, leading me to create a Pepe Silva-esque series of diagrams and incoherent ramblings in my notebook. It took me the better part of an hour and a half, and when I finally cracked it, I genuinely shouted Eureka in time with the trophy unlocking next to it. This got me wondering, what are some optional puzzles that have totally consumed y'all in the past? Did you crack the code? Are there any that still stump you to this day? Thanks for all your hard work, Eric. That's probably wrong.
It's
either Harry or Eric. Let me pull that back up.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's Harry. It's Harry.
Harry.
Okay. Don't you worry about it.
I have a couple. Well, I guess they weren't entirely optional, but sort of. Okay, so... Number one is The Witness. There were a couple of areas in The Witness, which I talked about way too much on Idle Weekend. But in case you don't know, I loved that game until I truly hated it. And there were times in the swamp puzzle area where I actually cut out pieces of paper just like from a notebook and arranged them into shapes.
Yeah.
And I put them up on the TV screen to like... try to fucking figure out, because the swamp puzzles, if I'm not mistaken, had to do with particular shapes and like how you sort of figured out what X meant or what Y meant. And when I got through that fucking swamp puzzle, which still to this day, the final part of that puzzle confounds me. I don't understand how the solution is what the solution is. And like multiple people diagrammed it out for me. And I was still like, I don't think this makes sense because of another factor. I'm angry. Why, game? I spent hours and hours and hours and cut out pieces of paper and everything. I'm still angry about it. This was 3 years ago or something like that, but I'm still mad. But yep, that's number one. I have another, but I'll let somebody else go as well.
So Destiny has had these puzzles that generally have been kind of ARG-ish insofar as it kind of requires a big, you know, like a large amount of people kind of, you know, inputting various codes and things like that. This past winter, they did something though where you could, as they put a lot of these args happen kind of off, out of the game, and then like you go into the game and find something to like input it into, sort of situation. This one particular one called Niobe Labs happened in game, completely in game, in such a way that I felt like I could go in there with some friends and figure it out and, you know, give it the old try. It turns out that it relied on information from previous arg elements in such a way that we were never going to figure that shit out. But God damn it, did we try for 5 hours and like still couldn't wrap our head around certain things that were like callbacks to previous steps of the arg. You know, and things like involving the fucking hilt of Charlemagne's sword, shit like that, like real world, like stuff that we'd never realized was being, was information that was being referenced. So, yeah, Niobe Labs would be that for me. It still haunts me to this day.
Gosh, so like Jindosh Riddle, I totally went all the way down that rabbit hole. I started working the problem while I was watching a baseball game, and like just for the length of a baseball game, was sort of dipping in and out of diagramming that all out, and eventually figured out on how I was going to solve it using like a series of like elimination statements that I was certain I could make, and then infer things from that. It was cool. It was a lot of fun. In terms of optional puzzles, I don't know, like, I think I've tended not to get too far involved with stuff like that. For instance, I'm somebody who, things like the Riddler puzzles in the Arkham series, right? I do tend to just kind of skip over that because they do get really hard and challenging, but before you get to that, a lot of us just search this room for the thing you haven't climbed or accessed and then see how it all works.
Right.
So I tend not to mess around with that too much. A game that I did connect with this on this level, but it's not... None of the puzzles are optional in this way. There's this game called Device 6.
I remember.
Which is an iOS game. Seth Rosen ended up introducing it to me one evening. It is kind of an interactive fiction, surreal horror puzzle game that's like done really elegantly for an iOS device. But it's like a series of... it is a game that hinges on kind of state changes. Like, there is sort of the superficial world you inhabit, the surface-level world where everything appears, like, roughly normal but somewhat cryptic. And then there's kind of, like, a photo-negative version of the world where, like, a lot of things are revealed. Like, to a degree, the hook of this game basically is it's, like, you keep toggling between the to serve humans and to serve humans for dinner.
Yep.
kind of reality. But the puzzles are really good. The problem I tend to have with puzzles is that I go way too far. So, for instance, I convinced myself that there was a cue to that. I basically solved how a code was working. It was sort of a code wheel type puzzle, and I'd worked out how the wheel was turning and what it would be indicating when it turned. But then I convinced myself that the indications that every other step was telling me to rotate the reference direction for the entire code wheel, right? So like north would become west. And so basically I created like an entire different axis on which the puzzle was turning, because just having it say, oh, check the coordinate for northeast, that was too straightforward for me. So I was like, ah, So east has become north. And therefore, all the indications that are saying north are actually referring to what was west previously. And yeah. And so that's, and this is how I ruin things for myself. Because I routinely, like, there is kind of the straightforward solution I'm supposed to get. And then frequently I will be like, well, that seems too straightforward. All but what they really meant was build an Enigma machine.
God.
Good.
And they rarely do.
I'll often pay attention to the wrong thing. Instead of like taking it too far, I'll think, oh, this is clearly what they're going for here. It's that there are three screws on the panel, and I need to figure out where the fourth screw should be. And it has nothing to do with the screws on the panel. Like, I will just constantly pay attention to the wrong thing all the time with optional puzzles. It's very sad.
Yeah. Next question here comes from Matt. Dear Waypoint crew, do you have a comfort meal or snack that you make for yourself? Something that at least involves some premeditated intention to cheer yourself up, put yourself in a certain headspace, etc. I find cooking helps me with depression and anxiety about finding employment, but there can definitely be detrimental effects if I spend too much of my daily time or budget on cooking. Deeper thoughts about small accomplishments in cooking and gaming while not getting sucked in are eluding me at the moment. What's your comfort food? What tends to do it for you? Is it just popcorn, Daniel? Like, is that kind of your go-to? Like,
It is a go-to. And it's also something I like making for, like, myself and a friend or myself and a partner. Because the amount that you make is, like, it's a pretty large amount that I can certainly demolish as a growing girl, you know. But it's like, a nice thing to make, like, for me and my partner. Or, you know, if I have a friend coming over to watch a movie or something, it's like, I made popcorn with real butter. And it's, like, the most involved thing that I've made. But I also have, for me, ultimate comfort food is my cheat day dessert, which is some form of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I've been actually really enjoying the dairy-free version lately, just as it's really good, actually. It's wonderful. It's made with, like, almond milk or coconut milk or something. It's really yummy. With some Peanut Butter and Company peanut butter on top, especially the maple kind, which is amazing, or the chocolate kind. They're both great. So that's my, like, go-to, like, hey, it's a cheat day. Have some dessert. Enjoy some copious amounts of sugar with some peanut butter that also has copious amounts of sugar on top.
Mine's a little strange. It's hummus. I'll make my own hummus and, like, eat, like, not really a gallon, but nearing a gallon of hummus in, like, a sitting sometimes. Because I love that stuff.
It's so good.
It's delicious. especially homemade, like...
wondering about that.
It takes a lot of premeditation, though, because I do it from dried beans. So it's like 8 hours in a slow cooker. So it's got to be the night before. And then I like...
Oh, wow. You're not... no canned for you.
No. Nah, get that shit out of here. it's cheaper. It's literally cheaper to buy dried beans than
canned. Yeah, that's true.
So I just buy in bulk and, you know, they keep dried for a while. But yeah, I will sit and eat an inordinate amount of hummus in one sitting as comfort food because I love it.
Do you eat it with something?
Usually, whatever I can find. Really, the substrate doesn't matter. But if I have a good pita chip, that's preferred.
Yeah.
If I don't, a piece of toast will do.
Yeah.
Carrots are okay in a pinch.
Celery?
I don't love carrots because I feel like they're too sweet usually. Mm. And I don't like it. That particular sweet and salt mixture usually. They're all right. When I'm feeling like I need to be healthier than just putting a bunch of bread and beans in my mouth, I will do the carrots. Celery, all the time. I love it. That stuff is great texture, but also doesn't particularly taste super strongly, so
yeah.
It's a perfect thing to dip into things. Love it.
Excellent.
For me, I think I tend to like doing baking a lot because... I think part of it is just, it feels like I have made myself the time to commit to doing that, right? So I think like there's a lot of things I like about the entire cooking process, but part of it is just going out to the kitchen and like sort of setting up the whole mise where like a lot of ingredients are pre-measured and weighed. And then you just begin going through the steps of combining them. You know, you wait your 30 minutes while the autolyse, you know, occurs, takes place. And then it's a lot of fun in that. A lot of the stuff, especially like leavened breads, pastries, it's not that much work. Like a lot of times you've just put this bowl in a fridge overnight. It will be more delicious tomorrow. you know, and so you wake up and you roll out of bed, you take it out of the fridge, you let it warm up a little bit, and then you bake it up. And so I think it's forgiving in a way that cooking often is not, because cooking, once you sort of have gotten rolling on a recipe, a lot of times you're kind of in it, right? Like, oh, I can't pause it at this point. Like, once I have done these three things, I have to finish the dish. And then it also probably means clean up afterwards. And that I enjoy cooking, but it can be a little more stressful. Baking is forgiving in a way that you can constantly pause it. Usually things are better for having waited a little bit. So it's kind of perfect for being a nice pastime. And who doesn't like bread? You know, nobody's going to be like, oh, damn it, Zach, and you baked more fresh baguettes. You asshole.
Like, you, like how dare everyone, you?
It's, yeah, that stuff's always welcome.
Yeah.
Do you do any sourdoughs? Do you have a starter somewhere?
I have generally... No, because there's been a couple things.
Yeah.
One is that when I was introduced to sourdough, I just didn't like the sourdough flavor that much. Like, just your commercial sourdoughs all have that, like, really identifiable, like, kind of tart flavor on the dough. Mm-hmm. That's just not what I want. I want the whitest white bread baguette, right? This thing is going to be a crispy, fluffy vessel for jam and cheese, and it's gonna be kind of neutral for that. However, I did start baking enough that I started to really wish I had a starter that would stay alive.
Yeah.
in between rounds. And so I think this fall I'm probably getting a starter, and nice. I'm gonna keep it alive. Cause yeah, I can't keep doing a quick starter. You know, the day of or the night before with commercial yeast. Because commercial yeast will die overnight, right? Like, you basically can't, like, it consumes its food so rapidly that it will not stay alive in flour and water for more than, like, 24 hours.
I recall seeing a question in the question bucket, and I don't know if y'all addressed it, but it had to do with whether or not you consider yourself the Paul Hollywood of the game industry. Are you Googling Paul Hollywood?
Yeah, who the fuck is Paul Hollywood?
Oh my God. Oh,
Great British Bake Off?
The Great British Bake Off guy.
Wait, you just said you like baking and you haven't...
No!
I like baking, not like... look, unless this dude has cooked with, like, Claire and Brad, he's nobody to me.
Wow!
You should watch
them. I watch, like, every season of that show at this point.
It's delightful.
It's so good. I don't eat a lot of baked goods for reasons, but, like, I love that show. So it is comfort food for me. Like, watching it is comfort food for me. Just watching, like, these skilled artisans who are all, like, nice, normal people doing this, like, incredibly high-level competition with judges who are very stern but very fair, and they're never mean. It is, like, the most wonderful show. It's really good.
It's very wholesome.
It's very wholesome, but without being cloying ever. It is very, like, we're going to be very tough on you, but we're going to be fair. Like, So good. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I've heard that show is nothing but charming.
It's good.
Because it is mostly like, as opposed to the cooking competition model, yeah, where it tends to be a little more like Gordon Ramsay's going to curse at somebody, or yeah, these like teams of like ambitious assholes are trying to like, you know, get Senpai to notice them.
Yeah.
I do tend to be a little more interested in the cooperative model. This is why like MasterChef Junior, I think, does it for me in a way that MasterChef never does.
Yeah.
Because like most kids aren't monsters.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, that helps. This is still a competition.
Also, Gordon Ramsay isn't going to curse at kids.
Exactly. This is still like a competition, and it's still like very, very, very high skill level, but it's just high skill level without anybody being a dick, really. That's just, it's more removing a bad element than it is sort of adding like, oh, it's just charming and it's all people doing their best. It's like they're doing their best, but they're also very good at it, which is like key, I think, to the product. Anyway, yeah. Paul Hollywood.
I was like, is that a... What's this guy through with Doc Hollywood?
He has beautiful, beautiful eyes.
It sounds like a fictional character.
I know. I think it's his real name, though. I think.
Really?
I think it is.
Fantastic. I assume that's a stage name.
He has great fashion sense. He's a gorgeous, large man. It's just, you know, he's great. Just saying.
And a load of gossipy headlines on Google now. So, I don't know about this guy.
You know?
Don't know if he's my goals.
I don't know what they are, but I am not surprised.
Yeah.
Also into cars. He's also into racing and cars. That's true.
Oh, man. This guy sounds maybe all right. Or at least somebody I'd probably get along with. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, we should probably leave it off there.
Yeah.
Before we start.
That is his honest to God real ass name.
I think it is.
Yeah. No, it is. I just looked it up. It totally is.
Sorry,
Paul
Rob.
Hollywood.
Well, you can send us questions to gamingadvice.com with the subject question. You can find all of us on Twitter at Waypoint. And you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Danielle, where can people find you?
You can find me at Danielle R.I. on Twitter.
Kato.
At @A_Kato_appears.
And our outro track is Miss You off the EP Pale Machine by Bowen. You can learn more about Bowen's music at waypoint.zone/Bowen. I can't believe we haven't updated this in like ever.
That's real. That's going to be up forever.
I think it still works.
Yeah, yeah. No, that still works. Waypoint.zone is...
Raise it to the rafters.
Separate fucking URL domain. So that one's going to be up forever.
A lot like discourse.zone.
Truly.
May it never die. All right, and we'll be back later this week with the other half of that Evangelion episode that we were working on.
22 to 24, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We got cut off last time by technical difficulties and the fact that we labored over two episodes for like 2 hours.
Yep.
This is what it's going to be for the rest of this.
It's getting dense. It's getting dense. Serious.
There's
like a
lot.
Thick bread. Yeah. It's getting dense.
So
that was
we'll
my
back,
problem always was my bread would come out in like a solid block. It was bad.
A bit stodgy.
It wouldn't. Yeah, something went wrong there. I don't actually know how bread works.
Gotta ask Paul Hollywood.
Yeah. It was like it was like the bottom was one solid like thing, and then there was a big bubble of bread on top. It was bad.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird. It doesn't sound like it was mixed well. Then.
Yeah, maybe that's I don't know how I fucked it up.
Oh.
Yeah.
My starter.
Yeah, there should be lots of bubbles all the way through. If you got one big bubble, that
it was like
suggests
one
to me
big
that, like,
bubble.
Yeah, like that suggests pizza to dough? Me there's like a layer of yeast.
Right. Oh, God. It was like imagine, imagine like you see a loaf, a boule of bread, right?
Yeah.
But like only the bottom inch.
But it's hollow.
Yeah, it's hollow. The bottom inch is like
you made a bread bowl.
Solid.
Oh, it's just nightmarish.
Yeah, it was not good.
It's like a thick clay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes, clay is a
giant,
exact,
like, empty dome of air.
Yep.
Oh, this is hellish. Yeah. I hate it.
And so that's why I don't break bread anymore.
But think of the amazing unleavened breads you could make. Maybe that was just
right.
Sure. The universe's way of being like Kato. Think of the taqueria you could open.
Right. Yeah.
Well, admittedly, you'd just be serving tortillas. The rest of the ingredients, kind of, we're not sure.
The universe was just like, you should be making pita to go with your fucking hummus.
I was going to say, Kato, yes. Don't call Defita. Get yourself some pita. I'm very sorry for everything. But I'm not.
Well, we'll be back later this week with more Ava and another episode of Waypoint Radio. Until then, Danielle, what do we say to the people?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
So there's that.
Kato, wait. 12's good?
Yep.
Sorry.
No, it's not good anymore.
21?
Let's do 21.
Okay.
Just swap those numbers.
Yeah. Seemed.
There we go.
Good? I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, so I played. Kato, do you play board games much?
Yeah.
Do you ever play a Euro game? Any kind of worker placement?
Carcassonne.
All right. Well, we're gonna go into some mechanical description so you can relive my hell with me from this.
Yay!
We'll talk a little bit more about Nightcall, Danielle. I want to hear about your experiences.
Sure.
But first, I'm gonna have to tell everybody about my morning and what's going on around here.
Good.
All right.